Hey, optimists. Every so often, the universe sends me a gift in the form of a fascinating new friend with a mind and spirit that challenges and awakens my own. This happened recently when my path crossed with Amina Ahmed, a fellow leadership coach and one of the most altruistic and enlightened individuals to have travelled the journey of the UK's social sector. Her experiences and the outlook that they've shaped in her are beautifully layered and nuanced, and she really lives her values in an exemplary way. I was honoured that she agreed to join me on the Chief Executive Optimist, and I really hope that she inspires you too. And please show some love by liking and subscribing to this podcast in your favourite podcast app. Namaste. Hello and welcome to episode 7 of the Chief Executive Optimist podcast, delivering resilience recipes for leaders and high performers and helping you to preserve your sanity and humanity in this time of relentless change. I'm Gareth Hawkins, scale-up investor, principal consultant and coach at Enterprise Insights in London. So today I'm delighted to be speaking to Amina Ahmed. Amina is a director, a lead social impact consultant and a very dynamic thinker with considerable cross-sector experience. She's had senior roles at Tameside Borough Council and a long-held director's role in a counselling support charity called Off the Record. She now leads an outcome-focused, change-facilitating and human-centred consultancy called Direct Path. And she works with leaders across all sectors to accelerate their development and growth, both professionally and personally, and to help create more fulfilling lives. So welcome, Amina.
Thank you, Gareth. Thank you for having me. And that was a great introduction. Thank you.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's been really exciting learning about you, actually, and I'm sure the listeners will find that also today. So straight in at the deep end, I'm afraid you've drawn the short straw. What we do on this podcast for all of our visitors is that we ask you to give some thought to something that has been forefront in your mind of late and share that with the crowd. So maybe that might be a book or a film or a talk or a seminar that you've attended or a new leadership framework or something now vogue, cutting edge. So what's on your mind at the moment then, Amina?
Okay, so what's captured my attention recently? As I've got older, I've become more of a fan of internet TV. So I watch Gaia TV, for example, on YouTube. And those things span a whole range of interests for me. And recently, whilst I was flicking through some channels, so to speak, I came across this lecture on YouTube by a neurosurgeon called Dr. Eben Alexander. And what grabbed me about it was he was talking about a near-death experience and his time beyond the veil, so to speak. And he wrote about this to some extent in a book called Living in a Mindful Universe, which I subsequently bought. So as a Buddhist, that interested me on so many different levels, not least because it was grappling with the notions of life and death. And Dr. Eben Alexander went from a purely scientific, rational approach as a neurosurgeon. And because of his experience, he became spiritual or metaphysical in a way. And he now lives and works with a combined approach to Western and Eastern worldviews. And he draws on things like the power of prayer. And he talks about the concept of love as being key, as well as learning soul lessons in this lifetime. So coming across these concepts and reading his book and listening to him on YouTube really validated my own framework in terms of how to live a life of purpose and what happens after life, perhaps. And all of this really fits into a life stage that I'm in, which is really actively developing much more love and compassion, letting go of any negativity in my life and healing past karma, which Dr. Eben Alexander describes as critical in terms of getting in touch with one's true self and ascending to higher levels of consciousness. So it's not light reading, I know, but it's something that certainly appeals to me.
And to me, that's very much in my wheelhouse, that one, I must say, Amina. I've not read any work by Dr. Eben Alexander, but it interests me that someone would come at this from a deep-rooted scientific basis, but into an area that is traditionally very spiritual and esoteric. Are you a believer in an afterlife?
I'm a believer in the eternity of life. Many, many different faiths describe what happens after life. And in a sense, from a Buddhist perspective, there's a viewpoint of you need to understand death in order to understand life. So I describe it in terms of two sides of the same coin, life and death. And if you were going to kind of say, give it a cosmological framework, you could say, well, what's manifest and non-manifest? So what's matter and antimatter? So it's form and formlessness. It's so many things. So for me, time is a construct. everything's in the present moment, only now exists. So where we go to once we've finished in this physical aspect of our bodies is all conjecture, I know, but ultimately I do believe that energy is never destroyed and it will just become non-manifest until a time it becomes manifest again.
Yeah, I think that's been on the fringes of, if you like, esoteric spiritualism for millennia. I mean, if you go back to Hermes Trismegistus, he talked about, effectively, without using the language that we would use today, but the manifest and the non-manifest, the matter and the antimatter, and how matter is sort of in vibration and everything is in effectively a state of vibration to determine what kind of state of matter, but that there is all this unexplained, as above, so below, element of antimatter that doesn't vibrate but has an eternality to it. And I find that hugely interesting when you think about the soul and you think about, you know, the even the quantum observer effect, how something can be brought into a sort of a temporal moment, a lifetime, as we should call it, but actually then go on to exist in a timelessness when it's not in that state. I think that that really does provoke, you know, thoughts about the Akashic record and how things are actually all unified beyond our lives. And if you look at the Kabbalah, it talks about karma, but in a, again, a different sense, and reconciling things within a lifetime, but that a soul could go through very many iterations before it reaches the perfect state of ascension with the Ein Sof. I think this wisdom is stuff that we've perhaps forgotten over the last few centuries. What do you think?
I agree with you. I like specifically what you talk about, level of vibration and frequency, and that's something energetically I really work with and believe in. I'm coming across much more around this concept that we're at a particular critical moment in terms of humanity, in terms of the life of this planet. So whilst ascension can happen on an individual spiritual level, there's also this concept of human beings collectively ascending and that this planet's going through some vibrational shift. So I think that in itself is really very, very fascinating. It's something I'm exploring more of these days.
Well, that's a super interesting thought journey that we could go on, I think, and hopefully we'll loop back to part of that in this further discussion, Amina, but I'm sure our listeners will find that really fascinating, and it probably aligns with many of their worldviews. Maybe you could give the listeners a quick whistle-stop tour of your career path to date. How did you get to where you are today, perhaps?
So after having my son, I was 22 at the time. I held a series of casual jobs in the early years. But after returning from a six-month trip backpacking around Asia, I decided I needed to really settle down into a career. So I went back to university and got a degree. And during that time, I was juggling motherhood and some community arts work. And thereafter, I went much more into a social care field. So I worked in an Asian women's refuge and then into a young people's mental health service. And really, that was my biggest career break. It came in that role. The organisation was called Off the Record. It was newly set up just 6 months prior to me going in there. And during my time there, I became the CEO. It was called a project director role, but essentially it was a CEO role. And the organisation expanded significantly. So whilst providing core services of young people's counselling, we were also involved with schools work. I set up a trading arm to income generate for the charity and also negotiated with the local authority at that time some of the first service level agreements over a 3 to 5 year period, which really gave the charity a lot more stability. And all of that was in the 1990s. And this kind of model of a trading charity was very innovative at that time. And during that time, I undertook counselling qualifications and took them through various diplomas, up to writing a master's by thesis based on some of the work that we were doing in schools, which was on a study of peer counselling in schools. So after spending 10 years with the organisation, I then went to work in a local government setting, working in children's services, integrating them around what was at that time a green paper of 2003 and then became the Children's Act 2004. It was the time of the death of Victoria Climbie and the learnings that came out of fragmented services. So my remit was really to integrate services both within the local council and the wider community in the area of benefit. So leading on things like children's trust arrangements, partnership working, common processes such as assessments, information sharing, and implementing that through workforce development. I left at a crucial time in 2011 when the austerity measures were really getting to bite in the public sector. So I actually set up my own boutique management consultancy called Direct Path And during that time, I've worked on a range of projects. For example, I've had a long-standing contract with the Women's Organisation, which is about supporting SMEs under a European-funded programme. And I've been an interim CEO role for a families charity, as well as head of business development in another charity. So in these roles, it's all been about delivering bespoke solutions and meeting the needs of marginalised communities in a socially impactful way. And interestingly, quite recently, I gave some brief advice to the Japanese government on social impact development. I also have worked with Vistage, the global executive leadership coaching organisation, for a year, and I've since gone independent in terms of setting up my own online peer groups. I've also been a non-exec director for the last 5 years on a trading charity. And in fact, during my career, I've sat on a number of boards and steering groups. So I've had the opportunity to work at all different levels.
So you've worked in both public, private now, and the not-for-profit voluntary charity type sector. From what I can tell, one has to be incredibly open-minded and agile, as you mentioned, and adaptable to work in just one of those spaces, but to be able to translate across all of them. What kind of a mindset have you had to bring to each individually, and how have you had to adapt to be at your most effective in each of those sectors?
When I really started off my career in the not-for-profit sector, I needed a lot of flexibility and adaptability, so to speak. Working in both the not-for-profit sector and the public sector requires a sense of integrity in terms of what you want from your services and the value you're going to bring to your customer. In all of these roles, autonomy has been really key as a driver in my mindset. And that sometimes worked in favour for me and sometimes worked against me. For example, in children's services, when I was integrating services, that was all about increasing the safety and care of these particular services. And I was working alongside leaders who had their own specific technical service expertise. So the role was very much about network leadership. And sometimes my own leadership style that demanded creativity didn't always fit with some of the mindsets of other leaders within local government setting. So it wasn't always an easy role for me to be in. But when I was working with the not-for-profit sector, I very much had a social business mindset, which is about having a business for social benefit. And I think that's much more in keeping with how charities see themselves now. But at that time in the 1990s, it was really quite radical. So when I latterly went into the private sector, it wasn't as foreign as me for other public sector workers who later went into the private sector, because in some ways I was going back to the flexibility and adaptability that I'd left. But I think in terms of effectiveness of each role, I've always had a strategic mindset in terms of working backwards from outcomes. And certainly working in the charity and the public sector, as I said before, this focus on best outcomes for citizens or service users is key.
You mentioned there integrity, autonomy and strategy as being three key drivers. Is there one sector where you found that those three in combination are more effective? Or is it the case that that's universal and it applies in each equally?
I think it's universal, because I think if you talk to the private sector, they would have an urgency for delivering really good services, because it's all about repeat business or business growth or an improved bottom line, profits, etc. In public sector, it's all about how you use government funding to get the outcomes that are policy driven. And in the not-for-profit sector, again, it's about how you create value that wouldn't exist in the public or the private sector, because there's a certain element of independence. And I think the people that work in that sector particularly are prepared to work at lower wages often, and with a greater deal of uncertainty.
You mentioned when you had to go into the public sector role, you were doing so at a time post Victoria Columbia, where it was about trying to address some of the shortcomings in services not being joined up that maybe had led to that, as we latterly found out. Fast forward to 2011, when you're facing the austerity world, did you find any conflicts that you had to grapple with personally around still trying to focus around those outcomes and those improvements, but having to reconcile that with the cuts? How did that affect your integrity or challenge your integrity at the time?
On a personal level, I probably reached the level of my tolerance of working in that role. So I needed a change. So that was more of a driver for me in terms of the cuts across services. That was biting across all different services. In terms of children's services specifically, in my time there, collectively, we had joined up a lot of services. And whilst the coalition government or the new government at that time, you know, was stripping some of that stuff back, there was definitely an emphasis to keep certain things. I wouldn't say that it was all lost, but I certainly know that the increased level of working for existing staff, the staff that remained in the sectors, and their need for adaptability and flexibility came much more to the fore. So actually, some of that mindset, which I was very much in favour of, became more of a driver. But that's my experience. I wouldn't like to say what the experience of another public sector worker would be. So sometimes I think that needs must, and sometimes working with less necessitates greater speed and flexibility.
So I want to just loop back from mindset, but into skill set. Clearly, you've got a very diverse skill set that you bring to your clients. I can tell from reading some of your social content that you're quite the proponent of lifelong learning. How has that served you? How has that served your clients also?
I've got a leadership style that embraces ambiguity, and I like to ask challenging questions as well as listening to the needs of clients or customers or service users. In terms of lifelong learning, I've trained as a counsellor and a counselling supervisor whilst I was in the not-for-profit sector. I also managed all aspects of the service delivery, so I really had a broad set of skills and mindset to draw from. So commercial acumen, drawing down funding, writing funding bids, dealing with donors, managing budgets, not overspending them, project management, implementing any innovation needed. All of these things have been really about drawing from a wide range of skill sets and being a master of all in that sense. Certainly when I went into the public sector, it was much more siloed because it was a larger organisation with many networks and many levels of leadership. So I think the not-for-profit sector was very key in terms of mastering all these different elements. So, you know, I think in all three sectors, it's about building the right teams around the priorities that are set and then needing to identify what matters most and focus on it and then revisit these choices continually. So in terms of learning and development, it's all about iteration and improvement. Certainly, in my experience, in my working experience, the way the three sectors have been in terms of now the profit sector or the private sector is very much about blending environmental social good. And that's like a merging of the not-for-profit sector as well as the not-for-profit sector merging in terms of being much more business orientated and the public sector being a blend of both as well.
So you suggest that maybe there's a bit of a convergence going on there currently then, do you, where values coming out of the second and third sector are actually playing into the private sector and vice versa, as you mentioned earlier, having to be innovative and having to be trading in a charitable context, almost learnings from each sector cross-pollinating. Has that been your experience?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think there's a real diversity in the different business models now and the way that they're all operating. So there is definitely a blending coming together. I think if that had been more at the time when I was in the public sector, that would have been a lot more freeing for me away from the bureaucratic restrictions that I experienced at that time. Because I did have a struggle with that in part, I'll be honest about that. But as I said before, outcomes-driven services was very much about that. So in terms of going back to your original point, which is about lifelong learning, I think it's about development of oneself in certain roles. And then it's also about what personal development you can bring into a role. So there's that degree of authenticity in terms of how I've shown up in work. And perhaps I'm probably being slightly different in that respect, because I think that I don't always show up in a way that might be expected. We started off the conversation with a really metaphysical kind of discussion. And I don't think that's something that, you know, if that's integrated in your whole core being, you actually ever leave behind. So it's okay to bring some of that thinking into whichever role you have, as long as it fits in a way. So a holistic way of seeing people and the world around them actually mitigates against siloed thinking and fragmented kind of services. So for me, when I hear about services that, for example, if somebody's in a health setting and they have a specific health need, the fact that an overall kind of analysis isn't drawn at the beginning, but, you know, specialism, which then leads to lots and lots of different testing from different departments, doesn't make sense to me, because actually it's the customer journey that just needs to happen in a way that's for the best outcome for the client.
You mentioned there about the metaphysical and a holistic worldview. And I think there's a lot of people in leadership positions, actually, who do have an awareness, if not a personal interest, in some of that metaphysical, the sort of vibrations of the universe we talked about earlier. You mentioned that you brought that through in network leadership in some of your roles. And I think that's how it shows up for many leaders in how they connect people, the power of connection, even if it isn't necessarily conscious. If you've got a greater sort of metaphysical, spiritual aspect to your character, I think it shows up in your interpersonal skills and the strength of networking. You've obviously had the opportunity to network in the various sectors with sometimes some very forward-thinking leaders, and partnerships appear to be quite forefront in what you do now with Direct Path. What are your experiences of how a good collaboration has presented itself in your career?
Certainly in the public sector, when I was working, leading on children's trust arrangements, there were various bodies that sat on these partnership arrangements, and they were really diverse. So, for example, education, health, police, the voluntary sector, network leadership is really key. And going back to what I said before in terms of really embracing ambiguity, but essentially it's about having some key things that work across sectors. So, you know, certainly having a shared language, you know, understanding each other's jargon is really key. Understanding the different purposes of different organizations and what some of their underpinning theories of change are, and what outcomes they're looking for as a result of their provision, how they reflect the needs of their beneficiaries, and how they measure the impact of that. Certainly in that role, some of the type of collaboration I was involved in was, for example, mapping service provision. So looking at what existed across all those different sectors in the community, and where there may be overlaps or where there were gaps, for example, and providing shared opportunities of resources. So that could be money, could be opportunities to work together, to share locations. So having those kind of elements of collaboration are really key to being able to bring communities together or organizations together. But it's also understanding the points of differentiation. So what makes them unique, and having a strong accountability. So in my time, it was about the children's trust arrangements, having the overall accountability for what we were delivering on in terms of integration of services. But of course, each organization has their own accountability as well. In the not-for-profit sector, which you mentioned before, having the funding constraints, needing to adopt a commercial mindset, then that meant really working much more in collaboration with the public sector and sometimes the private sector. So, yeah, I think collaboration is across all sectors, certainly been my experience in my working life.
And you mentioned that key to that is embracing ambiguity, which I really loved hearing you mention there, because that's not something that many people, let alone many leaders, find easy to do. But that leading to an understanding of the views, needs, and values of all of your stakeholders, I think is a critical skill to have, but one that is a muscle that needs toning typically. Taking a kind of non-traditional career path, has that helped you to embrace ambiguity? And if so, I guess how?
I've always searched for meaning in my career and in my life. And, you know, that's led me on a journey to self-actualize. And that's been through various life and work-related roles, and certainly been a driver throughout my career. Yeah, I think a non-traditional path, it depends on the person. The things I've described before in terms of leadership styles, the things that have driven my skill set, probably do belong much more on a non-traditional path, but it depends who you're talking to. I think for the younger person, it's probably more the norm now to switch careers, to have shorter contracts, to have that balance between life interests and being congruent with these things, as well as looking for vocational satisfaction. And I think the traditional career path has been more about stability, but there's a lot less of that in the world now, in the world of work. So creating an inner resourcefulness and inner stability to meet whatever challenges you're facing in life is something that's much more prevalent now. And in terms of myself, how deliberate the shifts have been have really related to the life stages I've been at. So when I came out of the public sector and set up Direct Path, it was very much about the end stage of my career and what I want to be doing. And certainly the work that I'm doing now in terms of setting up online peer groups is very much about the next 5-10 year plan and working in a much more virtual environment. So that's a new shift. Career paths go through their own cycles of growth and disengagement. And I think that's part of what's happened for me in terms of being at a point of being ready to leave something and embrace something new.
Has that search for meaning and search for self-actualization and doing things that are congruent with your life interest, as you say there, have they been key drivers for you more recently in your career changes?
I wouldn't necessarily say that. There's been an element of part deliberate and part serendipity, so to speak. When I was leaving the not-for-profit sector, I was really ready to make a change. And I'd been there 10 years and I thought, well, do I go more into private counselling, private supervision, which I was contemplating, or do I go more into strategic management, into a bigger pond, so to speak? And at that time, the role came up in the public sector and it absolutely fitted with what I was looking for. I think there's always been that element for me of really pursuing things that have actually been what I want rather than just falling into a role. So again, that feeds into, you know, looking for the right fit. Does this have the flexibility? Does it have the satisfaction, which is key? Does it have the autonomy? Is it proactive? Is it the kind of change I'm looking for? So all of those things really play a part in terms of the shifts. And on top of that, is the change compelling enough for me to make that shift? In terms of resilience, I think in order to manage that change, I definitely believe that, you know, my own personal start in life, which was probably non-traditional in itself. I'm from an immigrant background on a personal level. My mum died when she was very young. So she was just 25 when she died. And my dad came over to this country with 3 very young children. And I was the youngest of the 3. So I had a very tough and a very good training in terms of being independent and reliant on myself. And that's been something that's really been a kind of a natural default mode that I've gone to, rather than it being particularly that challenging.
I'm really interested to hear your family story there, because you talked earlier about resilience and inner stability. And I think those are recurring themes that maybe come from a profound, unexpected change in one's childhood, both in terms of losing a parent and changing country. Your dad must have had to go through quite a journey raising 3 kids and immigrating with you and your siblings. How has that affected you? Are you conscious of any effects that that's had?
I think that everybody's childhood has an impact on them for a better or a detrimental effect. And I don't think I'm different from many people in that respect. You know, I think in terms of understanding some of those challenges, certainly from my dad's point of view, I came to understand that later in life, perhaps when I'd dropped some of my own perceptions or even resentments over situations. I think all of this, it's as we started, you know, the conversation, it's all about, you know, what lessons we come into in life. And there's certainly an aspect of faith is that the more challenges you have, then the more you can hone your spirituality. And so for me, it's looking at these things as the greatest gifts rather than the greatest deficits.
That is a very, very powerful viewpoint. I'd like to just sort of let marinate for a second, because you can, as the old adage goes, choose to make lemonade or be sour about the lemons that life deals. But many of the people I've met in my life who've made a great impression on me have typically faced some amazingly great challenges in their career and in their lives, often due not to fitting into established stereotypes and being mold breakers in their own right. I'm a firm believer, as I think from speaking to you, you are, that we're all born equal. We should all be afforded the same opportunities. But I'm humbly aware that I say that as a middle-aged white British male with an inherent sort of element of privilege that comes along with that. There's been some progress. We've still got a long way to go to balance the gender mix in boardrooms. And we've got an even longer journey to go, I think, with making sure that we've got the right representation of all faiths and backgrounds. If you don't mind, could you share with us how your journey into leadership has been in business as an independently thinking British Asian woman building a career in the northwest of England?
Part of my makeup is really to respond best to challenges. I'm okay with risk. I'm okay with unexpected challenges. I definitely have a positive expectation of outcome, and perhaps a little bit too optimistic at times. It might be a bit higher than other people's, perhaps. But I like the opportunity to challenge the status quo and bring about change. For me, I've always played to my strengths, which are to, you know, be people orientated, creative, enterprising. So for me, building a career has been about attracting those kind of positions and having a high degree of contact with people. In terms of my ethnicities, there are situations where I've been aware of it sometimes being about bias. But on the whole, I can honestly say I don't think I've had a lot of negative experiences, although I'm aware that there have been glass ceilings at times. I have a Muslim name, Amina Ahmed, and I think that conjures up a lot of assumptions about me, sometimes in people's minds. But when I meet them, I think that's broken down pretty quickly in any kind of engagement. You know, I generally feel perhaps that to be successful as a non-white person, perhaps you do have to be more exceptional than your white peers. But I can't really say that I've got a lot of like evidence to back that up. As I said, being resourceful from my childhood is something that I've really drawn upon. I wasn't necessarily brought up in an Asian culture, so I don't have the advantage of being bilingual, certainly. So the roles that I went into weren't culturally specific, so that didn't probably kettle me into very specific kind of cultural communities, although I do have examples of working in different communities. In fact, this coming Saturday, I've been invited just to give some brief input into a webinar with Asian women, just sharing my experience of how I set up in business. I think whatever structural racism that may have held me back at times, you know, having the inner fortitude to deal with discrimination is something that's been stronger for me. And, you know, perhaps I have been overlooked at times in terms of ethnicity. I mean, one particular time was when I was in a boardroom situation. It was a steering group that was convened for a specific issue in a community. And the chair of that was an external chair. And he went around the room and asked everybody to introduce themselves and just say what their role was in the group. And he went around everyone and he came to me and I was ready to speak. And he completely overlooked me and went to the person next to me. In that situation, I felt really invisible. And clearly, I was confused. I mean, what was going on for me inside was absolute, you know, kind of like I had to really grapple with all sorts of, you know, feelings of my self-worth. But I just bottled it up and put on a brave face. And I think that's what a lot of people do when they face discrimination. I know it was, you know, colleagues of mine who were in that room looked at me and they looked shocked, but no one called it out because of the nature of the time or the nature of that situation. So I just had to deal with it. But, you know, that's also been a curse and a blessing because I think that, you know, has enabled me to develop much more emotional intelligence, to be able to read situations and people, have the empathy to know the pain of exclusion. And as I say, transform these into the greatest assets. I'm a great believer in equality and fairness in society. And I think people should get on based on their abilities and their suitabilities to roles. And I like to recognise diversity in terms of everyone's uniqueness.
As we all should, but it sounds like you were ahead of the time in embracing those sort of values. And I, for one, am pleased to see that rising in importance now in many boardrooms. But as I say, still a long way to go. We touched on family earlier. You have a family, some children. Have you any tips having pursued a rewarding career yourself whilst also raising a family?
As a working mum, my son's older now, so therefore I'm an empty nester. But, you know, when I was a working parent, it really did demand flexibility. And I've been fortunate enough to have a career where I was juggling different jobs that allowed me to do that. As you said, I pursued an academic route as well. So that's another place I was spinning plates at the same time. But me personally, I think my Buddhist practice has really helped me to be grounded. And I also feel that as parents, we play a crucial role, but our children come in with their life lessons as well. So despite our best efforts, karma does play a part. We can't do everything for our children, but we can give them the right start in life. And I can't say I've got it all right, but I do believe I did the best I could with the resources I had. And there's definitely learning for me along the way. But I think having a genuine desire to do your best is half the battle. When your children are very small, they have specific needs to when that are different to when they're older. They're different needs. So I think flexing around these needs is really important. Things do move on and change. And maybe that's a perspective that comes later in life.
Thank you. Some real insights there that I can hopefully look to apply in my own life. You mentioned Buddhism several times there as something that's clearly a tone that runs through your life, both family-wise, but also, I imagine, in your work life. How has Buddhism shown up for you in your approach to work particularly? Was it given you as a foundation to build on?
Buddhism is everyday life for me. It's the foundation from which everything else springs. And Buddhism's just a word. The experience is that of faith. I think that's the deeper way to see it. And when you have a life of faith, you're continually tuning into your higher self as the bedrock of everything that you do. So for me, I start the morning with chanting, Buddhist chanting, and I end the evening with Buddhist chanting. And I dedicate a significant amount of time to that. In terms of it showing up in my work, it's always about integrating my values into work. That's about making a difference, using my emotional intelligence and being creative, all of these things. So whether that was about setting up Direct Path, my consultancy at the age of 50, or partnering with organisations such as the Women's Organisation or Vistage, it's all about showing up in my authentic self.
When we talk about faith, faith and Buddhism aren't always used in the same sentence, oddly, even though it is a faith. I think a lot of people assume that faith is a sort of monotheistic faith in an anthropological sense, an anthropomorphic God figure. How is that different in Buddhism, Amina?
I don't think it is different. I think, you know, it's about a belief that is a central tenet to your life. So whether it's from a Buddhist perspective, I think a lot of people say, well, Buddhism's a philosophy. It's a way of life. It's a way of being. And I don't think that's different from a monotheistic approach. It's still a way of being. It's a way of life. It's about the rituals or practices you focus on in order to harness the integration between the belief and self. There might be other differences. They may be some very different worldview perspectives, historical flows, etc. But I think in terms of everyday practice of a spirituality, if it's coming from one's heart and from one's very being, it's all encapsulated in the word faith.
And in order for it to come from the being, come from the heart, it has to be an immersive faith, right? You can't half do it. But at the same time, one has to sort of carve out time for it. What methods do you use to allocate sufficient time and headspace to it in this frenetic life that we all live these days?
I think in terms of immersive space or immersive faith, it's about the fusion of wisdom and reality, self and the environment, or, you know, that fusion of belief in and action. So I think that's different from the allocation of time. So it takes motivation and self-discipline to sit and chant. But if that's integral to your being, then that's not a difficult thing to do. And I think people train in all sorts of ways. They go for walks, or they walk their dog, or they go for a jog, or they cycle. And I think it's just the same kind of discipline that's set aside. And very often people will describe that in terms of flow for them. And it's the same in terms of my life. And I think that creates a less frenetic kind of mindset, because by the practice of meditation or chanting, I find that inner calm where I can better respond to my environment. And there's a saying in Buddhism, which is, be the master of your mind rather than your mind master you. And I think that's very true. It doesn't make me a perfect person, but it makes me have the ability to reflect or respond more when I set the time aside, because it enables me to view things from a higher life state, or, as you talked about before, this frequency or vibrational level is much higher than if I'm not praying or using that as a bedrock to my everyday life.
I've heard you previously mention the phrase alignfulness as a sort of an evolution of mindfulness. Could you give us a few words on your take on that phrase, please, and how that fits with faith and how it aligns with work?
It's this idea of a centered self. I know the difference between when I'm not centered and when I'm centered. And I think that's different from being self-centered, and not to be confused. So when I'm centered, I have that ability to have that pause between something that's an activating agent and the way I respond to it. When I'm not centered, I can get pushed and pulled, because I think that's a human tendency. Our emotional brain kicks in, and then, you know, it's the fight or flight kind of stuff going on. So alignfulness is very much about coming from a centered self. And when I'm coming from that perspective, then I can view challenges that are going on in my life from a different perspective.
I mean, we've covered a lot of ground in our hour, and I really appreciate the time you've given me. We like to end every episode with our guests sharing their personal vision of the future. So if you will join with me and cast your mind's eye forward to, say, approximately 10 years' time, how do you think, or what do you hope that the business world, the third sector, and working practices in society in general might look like?
I think, you know, we're in such times of uncertainty, it's hard to say where we're going to be in 10 years' time. But I think certainly there's some big mega trends out there, demographics being one of them. I think people will live longer. Urbanization, I think there's going to be the rise of the super cities or the mega cities. I personally don't want to be living in one. You know, I want to live my dotage in a more organic life in the country, which I'm doing at the moment. Certainly there's going to be the rise of AI. I think production, organization, sharing of information, profiling of people's lifestyles, all of these are going to be a massive rise in technocracy. But my hope is that it's going to be used wisely and not in a dystopian Big Brother way, which I think there's a big danger of that happening right now. But if we can really unleash the potential of technology, then we can harness things. So, for example, to mitigate climate issues or to create abundance in terms of resources, I think they're all the positive aspects of technology. Obviously, it's going to replace some human labor areas. And I think that if we can see it in terms of people being free, being less wage slaves, more creative as people, that's all going to be a good thing. The millennial generation will be running things, as the alpha generation will be joining the workforce. And I think they're much more driven by purpose beyond the salary and all the stuff that we talked about, innovation, adaptability, collaboration. This is their age. And I think that's going to continue across all the sectors. And we've got, you know, hints of that now in the environmental, social good aspects of business. There's going to be a lot of businesses that don't exist now. I think diversity will be more of a key player, as will inclusivity, the gig economy, people working from anywhere in the world. I think these are all huge shifts. Could they happen in a decade? Probably.
Well, didn't we have quite a tour from our beginnings in this interview where we were talking about spiritualism and the esoteric, right the way through to the end of this interview where you've been kindly giving us a futurology, if you will, and a very succinct one, may I say, that spanned comprehensive futurology, but culminating in the technocracy, which I think perhaps allows us to use technology for good in a democratic way and build the society that we want to build. It's an exciting future ahead of us, I think, and I'm looking forward to us all playing a key part in it. And I wish you the greatest success as you take your next steps along your career journey. I really appreciate you giving up your time to talk with me at such a depth today. I've learned a lot, found it hugely inspiring and insightful. And yeah, I'm sure our listeners have too. So thank you very much for joining us today, Armina Ahmed.
Thank you, Gareth.
Armina was a great guest, and her talent for whispering to your soul is truly incredible. I hope you found our discussion insightful, and if you're keen for more inspiring discourse, please click the subscribe button in your preferred podcast app to receive our future episodes. In our next pod, I'll be speaking with cryptocurrency veteran and payments entrepreneur Michael Lowell, the force behind Sendit.money, a stellar blockchain dApp that is democratizing cross-border remittances in developing nations and making payments cheaper, faster and fairer in pursuit of the UN sustainability goal. If you'd like to join us as a guest on a future episode, please reach out on social media. I'm at GPG Hawkins on Twitter and on LinkedIn, or you can email me at podcast@ceoptimist.com. Until then, remember to live with intention, make choices based on your values, and not let the choices of other people define you.